Today I have a very special guest with us for this program, Ben Stein, who I think most of you have heard of from his writings, from his movie activity, and his humor as a comedian. But he has a new passion to which he has devoted himself in recent times, and that's the issue of intelligent design. And before we get into this conversation, Ben, I just want to remind our listeners of a phenomenon that took place a few years ago in America that shocked everybody in the literary world and certainly in the academic world when this Cornell professor, Alan Bloom, wrote a book that rose to number one on the best-selling list called The Closing of the American Mind. I'm sure you're familiar with
it. I'm very familiar with it. I think
and, of course, the thesis of that book was that in higher education in this country, there was a systematic closing of any inquiry for ultimate truth. And the way that's played out in the last decade or so with the closing of the academic world to any kind of inquiries of intelligent design has been a tremendous impact to our educational system. And you have produced a film. And the title of that film is Expelled. Is that right?
Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed.
No intelligence.
I didn't produce it. I am the narrator and host. It was produced by a very, very smart fellow named Walt Ruloff and two other very smart fellows. But I'm the only well-known on-screen talent in it. Talent in quotation marks.
Well, we were playing around with the staff here before you came in, and I asked them a question that nobody knew the answer to, and I said, anyone?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that made me famous. It took about 30 seconds to change my life. Yeah, I think your audience may be interested to know what intelligent design is in the first place. And it is the hypothesis that life did not originate randomly, not by random mutation and natural selection, but that there was some design involved by an all-powerful designer, and that we didn't just originate as human beings from lightning striking a mud puddle, that there was some design involved. And this, to me, seems so obvious, so intuitively apparent, so compelling, that it stunned me when Walt Ruloff, the producer, brought me evidence that noted academics had been fired, lost their grants, lost their offices, been hounded out of their communities for just questioning the idea that there could have been anything except randomness in the universe. And I couldn't believe that that was really happening in America, but it most assuredly is.
Oh, it's there, and it's there with a vengeance, as you know perhaps better than anybody right now. And when I look at this, I sense a fear from those people of an unwarranted intrusion of religion into the scientific domain. But I think what these academics fail to realize that this issue is not simply a religious issue, it's a philosophical issue of the highest magnitude, and as far as I'm concerned, what's at stake here is the integrity of science itself. You know, years ago I had correspondence with Carl Sagan over the nanosecond before the Big Bang, and he wanted to go back as far as that, and when I would ask him about what happened before that, he didn't want to go there. And yet, in our conversations, he insisted, as he did with his famous TV program and his book by the same name, that this is cosmos, not chaos. And that's the assumption that is the necessary condition for all of science. Because if reality is ultimately chaos, then it's unintelligible. And if it's unintelligible, then there can be no knowledge. And that's what science is the pursuit of knowledge.
Well, you're bringing up a number of issues that are extremely important to the work we're doing in Expelled. One is just the question of the universe. The universe could not exist without laws of gravitation, laws of motion, laws of thermodynamics, laws of fluid behavior, laws of heat flowing to cold. Where'd those laws come from? We don't just have chaos. We have an extremely precise set of laws that govern the operation of the universe and make life and make even inanimate existence possible. So where did those come from? That's one thing. A second thing is, if you were to say, well, there was nothing and then there was something, well, how did that happen? How did one day there be nothing and then one day there was something? What happened there? And to even ask these questions is so strictly forbidden, you cannot even imagine. And if you were to go to one of these, if you were a professor, assistant professor seeking tenure, and you even asked this question, you'd be out the door.
In some circles, it's certainly true. And it reminds you what happened in the 16th century with the great scandal with the church during the Copernican Revolution, where the bishops refused to look in Galileo's telescope, and we've heard of that black eye for historic Christianity. But what's often overlooked in that issue was that that was the same posture of the reigning astronomers of the day.
Yes.
They wouldn't look either because their pet theories were being smashed by the Copernican Revolution.
And what, see, I think that, but there's yet another, there's the two more issues that you're raising. One is, ultimately, Galileo's views took hold. Ultimately, he was, after some harassment, some considerable harassment, allowed to continue with his work. In today's world, people who question the dominant Darwinian orthodoxy are not even allowed to continue their work. If they want to continue their work, they've got to get out of Dodge and go to a new place and do their work there. Second thing, though, is there was no constitution in the days of Galileo or Copernicus.
Right.
We have a constitution guaranteeing freedom of speech. We have a constitution guaranteeing no established religion. If there's freedom of speech, that implies freedom of inquiry. Why can't we have freedom of inquiry? That's a very troublesome question. Second thing is, we do not want to have an established church in this country. I think we all agree that we don't want to have Presbyterian Church or the Jewish Church or the Muslim Church as the established church. We don't want to have the Church of Darwin as the established church either. We don't want to have the Church of Darwin saying you cannot do anything that contradicts any inference by any neo-Darwinian. And yet that's the church that is dominant in America's colleges and universities. That's frightening.
Well, you know, Ben, every scientist has some kind of epistemology, some kind of theory of knowledge, and most of them are reluctant to examine those foundational premises that they use to come to their particular theories. And I remember when I was a young student, one of the most important formative books I read was The Metaphysical Foundations of Modern Science. That is, what were the philosophical assumptions that the scientist has to have when he goes into his laboratory? And at the time of the Enlightenment, a whole new way of dealing with things came out called the analytical method, which simply stated was that the task of the scientist is to seek the logic of the facts. In other words, you get the data, you collect the data, observe, experiment, and try to find patterns. What they were looking for was design.
Right.
And that was what
logic
was jumping
itself.
Out of them.
Logic
itself presupposes
the Well, the word logic has a Greek root, which is extremely similar to design, and also extremely similar to the English word word. So that, actually, if you go back to the Greek root, in the beginning was the word, it means in the beginning there was design. There was a plan. And that seems to be ignored. Well, of course, if you even said that, in a university now, you'd probably be shot. But the there's a cell. Okay, well, let's go back to that. There's a cell. Einstein had a cell. You and I have cells. My dog has cells. A frog has cells. A plant has cells. Everybody has cells. Everything has cells. A cell is unimaginably complex with hundreds of thousands of moving parts and a huge amount of DNA information in it. If there's information, where'd the information come from? I mean, I'm not saying I know where the information came from. I mean, I didn't see God put the information there. But if it's there, did it come from lightning striking a mud puddle? Did it come from some random chance of one organic matter meeting another organic matter? Is that how the most complex system in the whole world, the system of life itself, came about? That's asking us to believe a lot.
Well, I think when you push it to the probe it to the bottom line, what you're finding here is not science but magic. You talked about it earlier about the idea of everything coming out of nothing. If there's any axiom that controls scientific inquiry, it's the axiom, ex nihilo, nihil fit. Out of nothing, nothing comes. Now, we would say not only out of nothing does nothing come, but out of nothing, nothing could possibly come. Because nothing does not have the power to produce something. And I wrote a book a few years ago called Not a Chance and explored the way that word, chance, is being bandied about in a sort of careless and irresponsible way, where people begin to talk about chance as if it were some force or power that can make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the word's a perfectly legitimate word to describe mathematical possibilities or quotients, probability quotients. But I had a discussion with the fellow who was teaching at the graduate school at Harvard in the philosophy of science, and I asked him how the universe came into being. He said, by chance. And I said,
what do you mean? And I picked
up a half a dollar, and I flipped it in the air, and I said, what are the chances this is going to come up, heads or tails? He said, well, it's 100% that'll come up one of them, but 50% for each. And okay, I said, now that I've flipped the coin, I want to ask you, how much power did chance exert upon this coin toss? If we knew, for example, the exact density of the air, where we started, you know, whether heads up or tails up, the exact amount of pressure that was placed upon the coin, how many revolutions it made, would we be able to predict with a greater than 50-50 cents chance where it would end up? He said, of course. I said, because chance didn't influence. And I said, you know why? And he said, why? I said, because chance has no power because it has no being. It's nothing.
Well,
and that's what they come back to. Nothing.
Creating something.
Yeah, chance means something if you don't have any better explanation. but to say we think it's chance that something came out of nothing, that means nothing. That means nothing.
Like David Hume said that the word chance is used as a magic word for ignorance. When you know what causes something, you say, well, it happened by chance. That doesn't explain anything.
Well, but the terrifying part of this, R.C., if I may call you that,
is that
this kind of ignorance, this kind of arrogant ignorance, has such incredible power on college and university campuses, and if you even question it, they call you a knuckle-dragging creationist, as if it were somehow more likely that something came out of nothing than that there was a divine designer. That's more likely. I mean, anything rather than admit to a designer, anything rather than admit to a divine being controlling the universe.
That's where the bias is. I spoke on this point at Yale with the faculty several years ago when I talked about the impossibility of something's coming out of nothing. And the professors were wowed, but they said they had never heard of this kind of thing. I said, well, wait a minute. You go back to the Enlightenment, and the reason they said that the God hypothesis is no longer necessary is because, like the French Encyclopedia said, now we know that the universe came into being and life came into being as a result of spontaneous generation. Now, what's that? Just poof, out of nothing, it comes. When they launched the Hubble telescope, I'm listening to the radio, I'm driving down the highway, this is no kidding there, and a very famous astrophysicist, I won't mention his name to protect the guilty, he's on the radio and he said, 16 to 18 billion years ago, the universe exploded into being. I almost wrecked my car.
Yeah.
I said, what do you mean, into being? What was it before? Non-being means it was nothing. Now, here's another one. Professor out in the West Coast, Nobel Prize winner, writes an article last few years saying, we can no longer believe in the paradigm of spontaneous generation. You can't get something out of nothing spontaneous. He said, we have to change our model, listen to this, to gradual spontaneous. I said, these people get away with this kind of stuff. I mean, if I talk like that as a theologian or as a philosopher, I'd be laughed to scorn. It's magic.
Well, but this is kind of, you put your finger on something very scary, which is that there are very few places where more nonsense is spoken than in universities. I mean, universities, which are supposed to be the residual fortress of knowledge and sense, are the residual fortress of nonsense. And in this particular case, yes. And by the way, I don't think our movie, or any of us connect with the movie, says that Darwin was a fool. He was obviously an extraordinary,
unbelievable
genius.
That's way beyond him.
Way beyond him. And, you know, in one particular way they've gone beyond him, which is very troublesome, he wasn't positive of his hypothesis. He wrote that it was a hypothesis. He thought it was proved, but he wasn't sure. And he said he wanted people to continue to debate this and hope for whatever result they wished for as long as man could debate. He did not want to close the subject ever. And he said that for people to think that they could know this to a certainty was like expecting a dog to understand Newton's physics. And I have a very, very smart dog, but I don't expect her to understand Newton's physics. But why would this man, who really genuinely did believe in ongoing inquiry, and that was how he got his work done, why would he ever be taken as the namesake by these evil, I shouldn't say evil, these confused people who want to shut down inquiry? I mean, he was the avatar of open inquiry, and he's being used as the avatar of the closed mind. To go back to your beginning simile.
It's amazing to me that there has to be a reason.
Because these people are
threatened by it for something.
They're threatened by it. I mean, imagine if you were a high commissar in Czechoslovakia, and you were living the good life as a high party commissar, and someone came along and said, communism doesn't work. It's a sin against humanity. It's not economically productive. It doesn't give rise to human dignity. There's nothing good about it. You wouldn't want to hear that, because if communism goes, your job goes poof. Mm-hmm. So I think it's sort of like that in the academic world. Plus people, you know, I hate to say this, and I'm sure I'm going to get hate mail about this, but people go into academic life in large measure because they're frightened people. They want a kind of sanctuary. And so when they're attacked or questioned even, they react very, very strongly. They're scared people. And they're really scared of intelligent design, because if intelligent design is true, and if in fact Darwinism is only goes so far and only covers a small amount of the territory, all kinds of threats to their power and status arise. You know,
not only that, what they ought to be afraid of are the implications of their own thinking, because, again, if we are cosmic accidents, if we're grown-up germs that have emerged fortuitously from the slime, where our origin was nothingness and our destiny is nothingness, how could we possibly have any significance in between? What you're seeing here is the death blow to human dignity.
Well, and Darwinism is the death blow to human dignity.
And the point is that you are insignificant.
Well, Darwin said at a certain